Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
Poor diet is now the leading cause of early death in men and number two in women across the globe. So the way our diets have changed is just so terrible and it's having such an impact on people's health. And at the same time, mental disorders account for the leading global burden of disability.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Food and mood is the topic of the podcast this week, where we're going to be talking about eating for mental health with Professor Felice Jacka, Director of the Food and Mood Centre at Deakin University in Australia. This is a re-release of the episode from a couple of years ago, but just as relevant. Me and the team are still putting together a collection of podcasts from the recent conference on personalized and integrative medicine that you are going to absolutely love. But in the meantime, we're diving into the archives where we are finding gems of podcasts, many of which come from 2020 and before. And on this episode with Professor Felice, we talk about her book, Brain Changer, which is all about how diet can save your mental health and tells the story of why we need to consider our food as the basis of our brain and mental well-being throughout our lives. Professor Felice Jacka first came on my radar when I heard of the SMILES trial, something that we've talked about a number of times in the podcast, and which we'll talk about in this episode as well. And she's also the founder and president of the International Society for Nutritional Psychiatry Research, ISNPR. And if you check out their website, which I will link to in the show notes on thedoctorskitchen.com, you'll be able to find out when their next conferences are. She's also pioneered a highly innovative program of research that examines how individuals' diets and other lifestyle behaviors interact with the risk for mental health problems. Today, we talk about where mental health begins, junk food and its impact on the adolescent brain in particular, which is quite worrying, stress and its impact on the immune system, the SMILES trials I mentioned, as well as the need to include quality fats in your diet. You're going to find this episode fascinating. It's a great archived episode that I think a lot of people perhaps haven't listened to, as we recorded this a few years ago before the podcast got to the size it is today. And remember, you can find all this information and more on the show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com. You can also check out the app, which you can download for free, and also try a free trial for 14 days. Android users, I'm sorry, I am working really hard, I promise you, to build the Android version right now. The team are working super hard on that, so hopefully it will be coming out later on this year. And in the meantime, you can sign up to the newsletter, Eat, Listen, Read, where every week I send you mindfully curated content, including a recipe that you can eat, something to listen to, something to you can read, and also things that you can watch if you're lucky, as well as a nice little joke at the end that a lot of you have indicated you really do enjoy. For now, please enjoy my conversation with Felice. I hope to do another podcast with her at some point in the future. But in the meantime, I think you'll find this conversation super valuable.
It was so delicious. It's my perfect meal.
Good, good. I mean, we've talked quite a bit about your book already and, you know, all the different topics. One of the things that we didn't mention was exactly what the Smiles Trial was. Yeah. So would you mind just telling us a little bit briefly about what that
sure.
entailed?
And also just the reason that we did it. So, you know, I discussed my PhD as being the first study to look at the link between diet quality and mental health in and then we went on and we did a lot more research in different age groups and different countries and different cultures. And, of course, other people were also doing research. And so by sort of 2012, we had this really quite robust evidence base linking the two things. But you can't assume that correlation is the same as causation, you know, and with these epidemiological studies, you're limited in knowing whether one thing is actually causing another. So you need to do randomized control trials, or you need to do interventions, experiments. And so we wanted to try and answer that $64 million question that people would ask us, you know, I'm depressed, should I change my diet? And we didn't have any evidence one way or another that that would be a useful strategy. So me being really naive and, you know, fresh out of my PhD, yeah. I went, I can design a randomized controlled trial, and managed after a couple of years to get the funding for it, although they cut the budget by 36%. So we were doing everything on the smell of an oily rag. It was really, really challenging.
Why did they cut the funding? What was the...
Oh, that's just what the National Health really? And Medical Research does. So... But, you know, we limped along and we managed to do this trial. It took 3.5 years to recruit everyone. It was very slow. But basically what we did was we recruited people who had moderate to severe clinical depression, which is, of course, really common, very, very disabling. And we randomly assigned them to receive either social support, which we already know is really helpful for people with depression, or dietetic support, so nutritional support with a clinical dietitian. And so for 3 months, people came in either weekly or fortnightly and saw either a research assistant to do the social support thing or a clinical dietitian. And the dietitian worked with each participant in the dietary group to help them to make positive changes to their diet in a way that was achievable, feasible, you know, not too challenging. And so, you know, to increase the amount of vegetables and fruits, to increase the diversity of plant foods, different types of beans and legumes, and often people hadn't even eaten legumes to start with. Mm. Getting people eating nuts and seeds.
You know what it is, you know, like now when I mention the word legumes, people kind of look at me funny and be like, oh, like, you know, beans, chickpeas,
lentils,
mung beans, all
that kind of stuff. Yeah, peasant food.
Yeah, exactly, peasant food. Yeah.
But also at the same time, of course, to reduce the junk and processed foods, to reduce the sweets and the fried foods and the packaged foods and those sorts of things and the soft drinks. And so over a three-month period, people were supported to do that. And then at the end, we looked to see how everyone was doing in terms of their depression scores, and we found a really profound difference between the groups. And as I noted, you know, the more people changed their diet, the better off they were. And it was quite a stunning finding. We didn't expect to see a big difference between the groups because we had quite a small sample size. But then a few months later, another group in South Australia did a very similar thing, but in a larger study in a group-based setting, and where they helped people to learn how to cook and how to shop and, you know, how and eating together and all the rest of it. And the comparison group was a social group, and they were really popular. You know, they're off to the movies and playing games and doing all sorts of fun things. So both groups, the people really enjoyed it. But again, we showed, or they showed, that there was a much greater improvement in depression in those who got the dietary support and who changed their diets.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it's phenomenal. I remember hearing about it because it was literally everywhere.
Yeah.
It was like all plastered all over the newspapers. You got some amazing coverage. Was that just purely out of, you know, it growing virally, or did you make a concerted effort to put it out there?
I write a pretty mean press release. Yeah.
Not blowing my own horn or anything, but yeah.
I was so... You know, we were kind of so stunned by the findings and just the size of the difference. Yeah. And there just was something in the air. We knew that there was a real appetite for this. Mm-hmm. A lot of the work that I'd done, because I've led so many of, you know, the first studies in adults and in children and adolescents, the first study looking at brain plasticity, it often gets a lot of media. Yeah. And to my mind, if you want, you know, knowledge to be transmitted through the community very quickly, you can't wait for governments to write, you know, public health messages or, you have to get it out there. And to me, always the context is that because of the massive changes to our global food environment and because of the activity of big food, poor diet is now the leading cause of early death in men and number two in women across the globe. So the way our diets have changed is just so terrible and it's having such an impact on people's health. And at the same time, mental disorders account for the leading global burden of disability. So the fact that the two things are linked is really important.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get that message out there. So, but I, even I was pretty amazed at the impact that it had. And, you know, we ended up in the Wall Street Journal and NBC and CNN, like just all over the news. And it continues. I mean, that was 2017 and now in 2019 we're still, you know, turning up in articles, the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, you know, it continues to reverberate, which is great.
One of the things that I really love about your book is the bravery by which you confidently talk about your own personal experiences with mental health, both your daughter and your personal experience. And that kind of ties in with that maternal and paternal responsibility for mental health or health during conception.
Yeah.
I find that topic absolutely fascinating. Would you mind just going into a little bit more depth about
prenatal conception? Yeah, so, you know, like many, many, many people, I had a long history of what we call common mental disorder. So anxiety disorder probably manifested in childhood. Yeah. That's when they often do. And then by early adolescence, I was starting to experience panic attacks, but also then clinical depression. And I had many episodes throughout my adolescence and really quite severe. Now, of course, that's not uncommon. And I had a very strong family history. My father had very severe major depression with psychosis. So had both of his parents. So the genetics were playing a really big role there as well. And, you know, I'm very open about this because I don't see why we should not be talking about mental health in the same way we'd be talking about a physical health condition. And similarly with treatment, you know, reducing stigma. But when my first daughter, when I was pregnant with my first daughter, normally I'd eat a pretty healthy diet, but I had just such severe, awful morning sickness that it was like having this massive hangover.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't even look at a vegetable and I ate, you know, all the wrong things for that first few weeks.
One of my best friends is actually going through that at the moment.
Yeah.
And she's a massive healthy eater and she can't look at a broccoli.
No, no.
She just can't.
Oh, it's really weird. It's like all you want is chips and ice cream.
That's literally her diet. Yeah.
I know. So, but also, of course, I was a really anxious, you know, first-time parent and there were lots of reasons why my eldest daughter might have been born being quite anxious herself. And we have no idea whether the food had any input into it, but certainly she experienced a somewhat similar trajectory to me in that she certainly developed panic disorder when her early teens and some depression, not nearly as bad as mine, thank goodness. But we just don't know whether, you know, what I did or didn't do in pregnancy plays a role in that. But the point I make in the book, and I think this is critical, is that all of us as parents have enough things to feel guilty about and we're doing the best that we can. And the key thing is that the environment needs to support healthy choices. So if you go out every single day and all you see is junk food purveyors and you go and fill up your car with petrol and all you see is soft drinks and packaged food and sweets and things like that, and these foods are so heavily marketed, they are everywhere. And we are designed as humans to want those high energy foods and they interact with the reward systems in the brain. And then, of course, people have kind of forgotten how to cook and we're busy and all sorts of reasons why we may choose the wrong foods. Mm. And this is where the food environment has to change to make healthy eating the easiest, the cheapest, the most socially acceptable, the most heavily marketed.
Yeah.
and, you know, teaching people the basics of cooking again.
And you talk actually about junk food and its impact, particularly on adolescent brains as well, and how they may have less ability to say no to these things because of the impact on our reward system.
That's right.
Your sort of idea for how we can actually improve adolescent health through food? Because at the moment, particularly in this country, I'm not too sure if it's the same in Australia, but chicken shops, fast food takeaways, all the major sort of fast junk food brands, they surround schools. They literally, like, if you look at a map, you can see that they populated around schools. They're directly targeting, whether it's intentional or not, that's where they are. How are we going to get
It makes me furious. I think the first instance, and I can really only talk about Australia and not other jurisdictions because I don't know what the planning laws are like, but in Australia, local communities don't have the power to say no to that because the planning laws happen at the state level.
Right.
So we need to give communities and schools the power to say, no, we don't want that in close proximity. Uber Eats is becoming a really big issue because then it actually doesn't matter where these things are. They can come anywhere. But, you know, in Australia, so around the world, as I said, poor diet, the leading cause of early death, responsible for, by 2030, according to the WHO, at least $30 trillion worth of health costs, and that's without factoring in all the mental health and, you know, things like dementia and those sorts of things. And yet governments have done almost nothing to change the status quo because big food is so powerful and their ability to lobby and the money behind them is just massive. But in Australia, there's at least the beginning of a discussion about adopting a whole lot of public health policy recommendations from the people working, particularly in obesity prevention. Now, to my mind, sometimes it's problematic if you make the whole conversation about obesity because there's a few reasons for that. One is that once you put on weight, it's very, very difficult to get it off and keep it off. So people often give up. If they think the only reason they have to eat healthily is to avoid being fat and they are fat anyway, they go, well, I might as well just eat the burgers.
Yeah, and there's a physiological reason behind that as well, because your body absolutely will defend that weight set point because it feels as if it's going into starvation mode.
Yeah.
And so that's why it upregulates your satiety levels. Sorry, it reduces your satiety levels and it will continue
you get more
to get
hungry.
Exactly.
And, you know, you put somebody with obesity in an MRI scanner and show them pictures of food and their brain lights up like a Christmas tree. Interestingly, that's lost almost immediately after bariatric surgery. I think that's very interesting. Yeah, and they don't know why and how that works. But the other thing about obesity, certainly in relation to mental and brain health, is that relationship between diet quality and mental health in all of the research we've done is quite independent of obesity. It's quite independent of body weight. Now, we know that depression prompts weight gain. We know that being overweight can increase the risk of depression, probably through inflammation. But the relationship that we see is independent of that. In the SMILES trial, just as an example, the average BMI was about 30, and that didn't change. No one changed their weight because of the diet.
What time period was the SMILES trial again?
Over a three-month period.
Okay.
So people didn't, and it wasn't a weight loss diet. But it was about improving the quality of your diet. And I think that's a really powerful message, is that don't worry about your weight. That'll take care of itself, because if you start feeding your gut and feeding yourself, your brain, with good food, you'll start to feel better. You'll start to naturally regulate the amount of food that's going in. You'll start to want to do more exercise, and all of these good things will flow. And if you lose a bit of weight, fantastic. But if not, don't worry about it, because you are doing the very best thing for your long-term health.
Yeah, that's music to me. I mean, in my first book, I remember the paragraph that I wrote about how healthy eating and what you should be striving for is independent of weight loss. If you go for weight loss, you're not looking at the whole picture. If you're just trying to adopt healthy habits and behaviors, you'd be surprised at all the other healthy aspects of wellness that will come to you. One of the things that you talk about in your book is some sort of like fad diets and supplementation, that kind of stuff. One thing that really stood out to me was the suggestion in the literature that a keto diet might be suitable or may have some benefits for schizophrenia. So a keto diet, just for those who are listening, is one where you have predominantly fats in your diet. You consume a lot of your energy and your calories from fats rather than carbohydrates or protein. It's a very extreme diet. It's very restrictive. There are some clinical applications for epilepsy, but I wanted to get your understanding of what potentially could be the mechanism behind why it might be useful for schizophrenia, and whether that's purely because of better metabolic control and glycemic control that we can achieve perhaps through some other less extreme measures.
I have to say I'm not a fan of the ketogenic diet. It's enormously concerning to me that it's promoted so heavily by so many diet gurus on the basis of extremely scanty, cherry-picked evidence. And, you know, really when you drilled right down, it's because people think that they can lose weight, and it's very heavily promoted by the bodybuilders and, you know, people who are very fixated on their appearance. Based on everything we know about the gut, it would be really bad for the gut, because the gut does not like high fat, and the gut really doesn't like low fiber, and that's what a ketogenic diet is. However, there are some clinical applications. So in epilepsy, there's quite a large proportion of people with treatment-resistant epilepsy that will respond to a ketogenic diet. It's an incredibly strict diet. It's a really awful diet, and people struggle to stay on it long term. And it can have a lot of negative health impacts, and they know that from people with epilepsy. But colleagues of ours have done a lot of animal research, and they think that it may be of use in psychosis, like we're talking about quite a serious mental disorder. And there's been a few case studies of people with psychosis who have been put on a ketogenic diet and have had a reduction in their symptoms. Now, because these happened in the States, we don't know if that's just because they stopped feeding them junk food There's a whole lot of reasons why that might have happened. Yeah. But one thing we do know about psychosis and schizophrenia is that many people with those conditions have inbuilt problems with glucose metabolism. They're not, they don't deal with glucose in the same way that someone without that condition does. So we're hoping to generate some empirical data on this. So the study, and it's going to start in the next couple of months, will be conducted in an inpatient unit in Finland. And the reason it's going to be in Finland is because in this hospital, they already have patients with epilepsy who are in there for treatment. And so the hospital menu has the ketogenic diet as a, part of its protocol.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And then also these young people with schizophrenia, psychosis, they're in there for a period of time. They can't get out. And there's no cafeteria. And if I'm told there's Uber Eats, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So basically, it's almost the only way that we're ever going to be actually able to test this.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested. But even if we do see that there's a possible benefit to people's psychotic symptoms, again, we don't know if that's because we've removed things from the diet that they may be reacting badly to. We're very interested in the possible role of food sensitivities in people with psychosis. We think maybe a small proportion of people have, because of, and this goes back to the gut, some fundamental issues with the gut that could go right back to the start of life, that they don't deal as well with a whole lot of different dietary inputs. So removing potential food allergens from their diet may also have a benefit. So we want to test that as well. But what we are doing, and I think this is going to be really, really interesting, is we're doing a very detailed investigation of the impact of on the gut of a ketogenic diet. Now, this is our modified keto diet that has less saturated fat, more mono and polyunsaturated fat, avocados and nuts and fish and that sort of thing. But it's still a really strict ketogenic diet. And we're going to take lots of poo samples and lots of blood samples from about 10 people and really track that in great detail over a month to see what happens to the gut, because based on everything we know, it's going to be really nasty for the gut. And absolutely, anything that's bad for the gut is going to be bad for you.
Yeah, I've read
there may be adaptation. We don't know.
Yeah. And I've heard of some adaptations looking at a healthier keto diet. Not that I think there is a healthier version. But I've come across some studies that a keto diet is the equivalent to having a round of antibiotics in terms of what it does to your microbiota.
Yeah.
So that's something to always bear in
mind. I just came across a new study, and I don't know how I missed it because it was published a few months ago now, but it was published in Oslo. It's a really important study. When you look at the ketogenic diet and the health, what people are purporting it does to reduce blood glucose and all of those sorts of things, we really don't know whether that's just because people have lost weight and you get a lot of these health benefits in the short term when you lose weight. This study in Oslo, it took more than 30 young adults, healthy adults in the healthy weight range. So they were really healthy, they were nice and slim, doing all the right things, and they put them on a keto diet for 3 weeks. Now, what happened to their blood lipids is just extraordinary, particularly because there was such pronounced variation. So they all got exactly the same food, but LDL cholesterol increased between 5% up to 107%. Oh, wow. So in some people, it just went off the scale. Mm. Even more concerning, there were two really quite serious adverse events myocardiopathy.
Okay, yeah.
And then an autoimmune thyroiditis.
Oh,
is
interesting. That right? How yes, you say yeah, it? Autoimmune yeah, thyroiditis. Yeah.
Two
yeah,
young, healthy people within yeah, 3 weeks. In fact, that happened really quickly, within a week or so.
Yeah, you can almost understand why that might happen as well, because if you're giving an insult to your gut microbiota and that's inherently involved in your immune regulation, and you have a patient that has a propensity toward autoimmune disease because of a genetic predisposition, then you're essentially lighting the fire with a keto diet.
That's right. And it just blows my mind that people are advocating this as a sort of diet that cures cancer and whole works. It's really, I think, unethical, because at this point, we do not have the data to say that this is a safe thing. Some people may respond really well to it, but others are not going to respond well. And what this study showed was that some people experienced a really massive increase in their LDL cholesterol, which we know is a profound risk factor for heart problems, no matter what the conspiracy theorists and the diet gurus say.
There's so many things that I wanted to chat to you about regarding the immune system and meta-inflammation. We touched on inflammation earlier when we were cooking. But I think you've got a really nice analogy for explaining what inflammation is and what meta-inflammation or low-grade chronic inflammation is and how that relates to mental health.
Yeah, well, I mean, based on what we know, and I'm not an immunologist, you know, if you have an injury or a severe virus, your immune system springs into action. And the little messengers that are part of that whole immune response, these proteins are called cytokines. And I mean, there's a whole lot of different ones. And basically, they run around and make sure that things happen and that you get healed, hopefully, if your immune system's working well. But what you don't want is those cytokines hanging around over the long term. But what we know is that there are a lot of things in our Western life that really prompt this low-grade inflammation, this systemic inflammation, where these cytokines, it's like your immune system is on low-grade alert all the time. And they're things like not having enough sleep and sedentary behaviours and smoking and lack of vitamin D and stress and all of these things. But of course, diet is a really big part of it. We know that a healthy diet that's high in plant foods and whole grains, etc., prompts a reduction in inflammation. Then we know Western diets increase inflammation. But of course, inflammation doesn't just happen in your body, it happens in your brain as well.
Well, this is a relatively new recognition, right? That inflammation of the cytokines can cross the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah. And I'm not an immunologist, so I don't want to go into too much detail there, but there's all sorts of new knowledge coming out of the field that I think is really interesting. But basically, you know, the driver of all of this, so we know about the immune system and its role in prompting depression. And we know this from a whole number of different studies and different ways of coming at the research. And we know that brain plasticity is involved in mental health and that diet influences mental health. But what we now know is that the gut and the microbiota that live in the gut play a key role in all of those things. So they're it's very, very important. It's like the heart of your immune system, your gut. It also influences the health of your brain, the integrity of your blood-brain barrier, your brain plasticity, all of these things, as well as your body weight and your metabolism, etc. Now, it's a very new area, and it has to be said that most of what we know comes from animal studies. So we have to be careful in extrapolating too much. And we're also really struggling with the methodologies. You know, like, what does this mean? Just because there's a bacteria in there, like, what is that, good? Is it bad? Yeah. And then we're finding out that bacteria can do all sorts of different things, and sometimes they can be baddies or goodies depending on who else is in the zoo and, you know, how they're working together. So it's horribly complicated. But there are some basics that we're pretty sure about. And the first thing is that the gut bacteria, their primary role is to break down dietary fiber. So the dietary fiber that your human enzymes can't break down, that's their job, and they break down the dietary fiber. So that's just in the things like the beans and legumes and plant foods and whole grains, all the stuff we've just eaten. And when they do that, they produce a whole range of what are called metabolites, many, many different ones, and we're only just starting to figure out about some of them. The short-chain fatty acids have been looked at quite extensively. Short-chain fatty acids interact with pretty much every cell in your body through these G-protein-coupled receptors, and they influence how your genes behave. They are very important in the immune system and the health of your gut lining. It should have a nice thick mucosal layer. That's really important in having good immune health. It's many things that can break down that layer, and then you get this what's called metabolic endotoxemia, where you get these pro-inflammatory things getting out of the gut and into the bloodstream. But the gut bacteria do so many things. They synthesize vitamins, they synthesize neurotransmitters, they also prompt the synthesis of neurotransmitters. Now, we don't know that those neurotransmitters actually get into the brain. We do know that more than 90% of serotonin is actually produced in the gut, but it may not cross the blood-brain barrier. But those neurotransmitters do signal to the brain via the vagus nerve, the gut-brain axis. But the bacteria also control how much serotonin is produced by the metabolism of tryptophan, and they're in charge of that. So there's a whole lot of different ways by which we think the gut bacteria interact with the brain and behavior, and we're just starting to really do the studies in humans to try and unpick all of that.
Yeah,
but it's very new.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people kind of jump the gun with a few things that you probably mentioned, right? So tryptophan, specific types of dietary fibers, and a lot of spin-off supplementation sort of practices have come about. You were just telling me before the pod about how you were just at a recent conference and you came across some really interesting research looking at which supplements or nutraceuticals may have benefit and which don't. And you were saying there's pretty thin evidence, really.
Yeah. Colleagues of mine have done just recently a mega analysis, which is like a meta-analysis of all the meta-analyses. So it basically brings together everything we know from randomized controlled trials about the impact of supplements, nutritional supplements in psychiatry. And pretty much the evidence is pretty limited. EPA, which is part of the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids like fish oil, seems to be helpful for people with clinical depression if they have high levels of inflammation, which is about half of people with clinical depression. So EPA, yes, tick, but again, short-term, this is not long-term, short-term. Methylfolate, it's a form of folate that has some pretty good evidence. And again, it's during the acute phase. It's when people are depressed. And what happens, of course, when you have many different sorts of medical conditions, but including depression, your immune system is activated. So you have more inflammation. And what that inflammation does is it kind of burns up your nutrients in a way. You get this sequestration of nutrients and your nutrient levels drop, and you also get oxidative stress, and that interferes with the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids in the brain cells, because they make up an important part of the brain, of the neuronal wall. So that's why I think the EPA seems to be useful, because it can bring that back, and same with the folate. There's some evidence for something called NAC, N-acetylcysteine, which is a precursor.
Emergency medicine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, again, it's something that's short-term. I think it has some evidence for efficacy in schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. I wouldn't be taking it over the long term.
Right, okay.
I think that it can break down the mucosal layer. I'm not sure, but that's what I've read. And
what's the mechanism by which N-acetylcysteine might be working?
I don't know. Yeah. I'd need to look into it further. But
in an emergency, we use it for paracetamol overdose.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And it's great for that in a short
term.
But
yeah,
it's not something that I would be taking long term.
Gotcha.
And this is the thing, when you take a supplement, you're not taking it with all the other cofactors and things that you should be consuming. I don't take supplements. I don't actually trust them. Ever since I found out that antioxidant supplements, so vitamin C or vitamin E, you take them before exercise and you lose a whole lot of the benefits of exercise because it interferes with this whole really complex processes.
Yeah, I remember coming across that actually because vitamin C, particularly amongst the sort of physio or the personal training community, has been thought of like a no-brainer after exercise because it's an anti-inflammatory. But what you're doing is blunting the benefits of exercise, which lead to ultimately shearing of your muscles and inflammation. And it's that little bit of low-grade inflammation that actually leads to resilience of the body over time. It's almost like the plant hormetic effect. I'm fascinated by this theory of, like, you know, a little bit of bad is good for you in the long run. So that's interesting. So no vitamin C or vitamin
E. I'll take a bit of vitamin D in winter time, but I do try and get it from the sun if I can, and I'm Australian, so I get lucky to be there.
we have recommendations to take vitamin D3 now in the winter months, but as you've experienced our summer in June, it's not always sunny over here. So I think vitamin D is pretty important for people in the UK.
But that's about the only thing that I take. I've never taken supplements.
Yeah.
Probiotics, you know, the evidence is pretty mixed, and I would much rather be getting fermented foods into me. Yep. And I think fermented foods is really interesting because they've been part of traditional diets forever. There's a lot of misunderstandings about fermented foods. So say if you took kombucha, for example, fermented tea, and people will say, oh, but all the bacteria are dead because they've eaten all of the sugar substrate. They've and now they've died off because they don't have anything else to eat. So there's no point taking it. Well, actually, that's not how it works. So what happens is during the fermentation process, those bacteria are producing all of these metabolites. So many, they're called biogenics, and they're multitudinous, and we don't even know what most of them do. But we also know that the bacteria can still have bioactive effects, even if they're dead. So I think fermented foods are great for a whole range of reasons. We're really keen to test them in clinical trials, and that's something we're working on at the moment. Mm. And also, they're just delicious.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like I just love. I make my own kefir. I love kombucha. I have it every day.
And do you have your own so you make your own kefir at home with
With the grains. So simple, so cheap, and just so tasty. And then I make smoothies with the kefir. I love it. Yeah. My husband not so keen. I'll get him there.
Yeah, I've heard of this term banded around actually called psycho. Probiotics, which are probiotics that potentially have the impact or can have the impact on mood. But I think that you're right, it's a fascinating area of research, very, very much in its infancy at the moment. So at the moment, it's just probiotic foods.
Yeah, and there is some really interesting data, though. There was a fantastic study Bob Yochen's group published probably about 6 months ago, where they took, and this is to me the most compelling study so far in psychiatry, patients with bipolar disorder, like serious bipolar disorder, who had been hospitalized with mania. When they came out of hospital, they were randomly assigned to get either probiotics or placebo. And then they were followed over time to see how long it would take for them to go back into hospital with mania. And there was a really big difference. The ones on the probiotics took a lot longer to go back into hospital.
Gotcha.
So that's very cool. But the psychobiotics, so Professor John Cryan
and Ted Dinan, from Ireland, right?
Great buddies of mine, and they're really the world experts, you know, and they've got a great book called Psychobiotics, which is all about this. But they would say, look, 99% of the bacteria, the strains that they've tested in animal models don't do diddly squat. But there are some and I do think that there's probably huge potential there. It's just that we're not there yet. And going and getting some probiotics off the shelf and consuming them is probably not particularly worthwhile, unless maybe if you've had antibiotics, it's certainly not going to hurt.
Exactly.
But I would be getting the kefir and the kombucha and the tempeh and the sauerkraut and everything else into me.
It's something I actually tell patients whenever I give antibiotics. There's no evidence behind a probiotic supplement. It's unlikely to do any harm. I'd prefer you get it from probiotic foods, but we're just not there yet. And there's so many different variations as well, right? I mean, depending on your genetics, your current state of your microbiota, whether you're dysbiotic or not, it's almost like the keto diet. For some people, it's great. For other people, absolutely deadly.
Yeah.
And potentiates, in some cases, autoimmune conditions, which you talk about in your book as well, which I was quite pleased to read about. And also, there was a study that you mentioned. It was something that I wrote an essay on recently. I think it was O'Keefe and colleagues, and they did a crossover study where they took people who were still living in Africa, in South Africa.
Oh, I think it's one of my favorite studies.
It's a fantastic study.
It's just amazing.
And then they crossed over the diet with people of African origin who were living in America and therefore eating a Western diet. And they crossed them over for 2 weeks, and they found profound changes, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we know that people who are living more traditional lifestyles have a much healthier gut microbiome, more diversity, more short-chain fatty acids, all of the stuff. And they compared South Africans living a rural traditional lifestyle to African Americans having the standard American diet. Yeah. And of course, their gut looked really kind of awful and had higher levels of inflammation. And these markers that we know risk factors for bowel cancer. But that was the cool thing. They swapped their diets for 2 weeks, and the poor rural South Africans, their, you know, their gut health went down the toilet, yeah, so to speak, and yeah, the inflammatory markers went up, but it got better in the African Americans. That's so powerful. That's saying in 2 weeks you can have profound changes on your in your health by just changing what you're feeding your gut microbes.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's incredible that. And so to summarize, I don't, because there's so much information packed in your book. I mean, you talk about dairy, gluten, specific diets. You even put the details of the MODI diet that you put in, that you used in the SMILES trial. If we were to categorize what things that we need to be doing for mental health, what sort of things? So we talked about whole grains and fiber, mm-hmm, which we had in our lunch today. Yeah. What other things are you looking at? And fatty fish supplement or potential supplements.
But. Look, I think it's really important to understand that you don't have to get this perfectly right. And, you know, I go very much for the 80-20 rule. In Australia, average, like teenagers are having on average 7 serves of junk food a day. Seven serves.
Wow.
Less than 0.5% of Australian children and adolescents are getting the recommended intake of veggies and legumes. Less than 5% of adults. In America, something like 60% of their average energy intake is coming from ultra-processed foods.
Wow.
So this is not just a problem of people who are poor or uneducated. Mm. It is a massive, on a global scale. So if you moved your diet to be 80% pretty good, you know, you would be doing so much better than the vast majority of the population. And then that still allows for, you know, I love ice cream. Yeah. Friday night, ice cream time. You know, I like chocolate. You know, I'm not super, super strict, and it's not prescriptive.
You've got to give you an ice cream recommendation for Melbourne. I know Melbourne's like a hotbed for new restaurants.
Messina.
We have a Messina, a bunch of Messinas in Sydney.
Yeah.
Did it originate in Melbourne or Sydney?
No, actually. Okay, not sure. But I also love, there's many, especially around Carlton, around the Italian area. Yeah. So much good gelati. I know, I love ice cream.
Okay.
So, you know, 80% of your diet, you're just going for whole foods, and it doesn't have to be that difficult or complicated. You know, porridge for breakfast, yay.
Yeah.
You know, a bit of Greek yogurt with some oats on top and whatever, yay.
Yeah.
Lunch like we had today, just, you know, good quality sourdough bread, Rivitas, whatever. The sorts of recommendations we gave in the SMILES trial were dead simple. They were like a, you know, Rivita type biscuit and a tin of tuna and some sliced salad.
Yeah.
Bang it on. That's it's cheap, it's easy, it's quick.
Yeah.
I use...
And for that simple diet to have that dramatic effect over 3 months.
It's just extraordinary. Yeah. So you introduce fiber. Fiber is key. That is number one. Polyphenols, you know, come in all the colourful fruits and vegetables. They seem to be really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really interesting studies showing that if you get rodents and you put half of them on a high-fat diet and the rest on a normal diet, the ones who are getting the high-fat diet, of course, they get really fat and they put on lots of weight. But if you take a third group and you give them that high-fat diet, but you also give them polyphenols in the form of, you know, blueberry supplementation or whatever, they only put on half as much weight.
Wow.
So that's the only thing that's different.
Yeah.
And it mitigates weight gain. So you got to look after your gut.
Yeah.
Your gut, and I think that makes it easier for people. They get told that they should eat their fruits and veggies, but they don't really know why. And they think, oh, well, maybe one day I'll have a heart attack. But that's off in the future.
Yeah. But and if often you say, people reduce like the berries, for example, just to its polyphenolic components, so the flavonoids and stuff like that. But actually, you know, it's the fiber. It's all the other parts.
All the other things
the
that we haven't
food.
Even started to measure yet. This is what's so powerful about plants.
Mm.
But just this knowledge that if you feed your gut, you're going to be doing good. And you don't need to know the detail of which bacterial strain is doing what. You just need to know that your gut bugs need fiber to do what they do. If you don't have enough fiber, they can't do what they do. You just need to know that lots of different types of fiber and different types of plant food help lots of different types of bugs to live there. Yeah. It's like a zoo. You want this real biodiversity in your gut. My husband and I have just written a kid's book.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
Another book.
Yeah, and it's called There's a Zoo in My Poo. And the idea is that we want to get kids actually going, I'm the zookeeper.
Yeah.
I'm in charge of these guys. I've got to look after them.
Yeah.
And that means I've got to feed them the right things. And I think that's true for adults as well. That yeah. It's making it very concrete like that is going to be really powerful.
That's brilliant. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah. It's hilarious.
It'll help parents, I think, as well. Think about it.
Right? I know. And it's full of illustrations because my husband's a crazy illustrator. But it's also full of, you know, poos and bums and farts and mucus and all the things that kids love. Yeah. So we had a lot of fun doing that together.
Oh, great. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, it's funny. But I think that idea that this is something very concrete, it's about your gut, you can change it really fast.
Yeah.
You just need to make those switches to your diet.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. We're going to be starting with our new episodes next week from the conference, the Integrative and Personalized Medicine Conference. You're going to find the conversations there absolutely enlightening and packed full of tons of new research that we're dived into with our distinguished guests. In the meantime, do check out the show notes where you can find out about Felice Jacka's book, Brain Changer, as well as signing up for the newsletter, Eat, Listen, Read, where I give you something to eat, something to listen to, something to read, and something to watch sometimes every single week. You can find that on thedoctorskitchen.com/newsletter, and you can sign up for a free 7-day meal plan as well using that link. Until next time, I'll see you there.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.